Okay, in order for us to have an understanding of what Jesus is teaching in Matthew 24 to his disciples, we have to go back to the previous chapter for just a few moments' time. I want to remind you, and we didn't actually have an opportunity to study this chapter, so it's put us at a little bit of a disadvantage. It's pretty straightforward with regard to the woes and condemnation that is expressed by Jesus concerning the scribes and the Pharisees. He talks about their hypocrisy, by their impure motivations with regard to their religious activities, and also with regard to their treatment of the righteous. And those things are all discussed in the verses, let's say, leading up to about verse 29 of the text. So he's condemning the Jews of that day, and specifically the Jewish leaders of that day, with regard to their ungodliness. Now, I want you to notice in verse 29, the final woe that he pronounces, he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets." So, again, he is pronouncing these woes. Understand their, I would suppose you'd say their religious arrogance, as they were talking about the fact that we care for the prophets. We like, we're devoted to the things of God, not like the ones that went on before us. When Jesus is basically saying you're no better and no different than they are. And so you'll notice his response to them in verse 31. He said, "Therefore you are witnesses against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell?" So he basically says their contention that they were better than those who went before is not true. You're as guilty as they are of the same kinds of sins. Now with that, notice in verse 34 his statement. He said, "Indeed, I send you prophets, wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come to pass upon this generation." Now, it's important that we note, especially verse 36, with regard to these pronouncements of woe that he expresses as a result of the kinds of sins that they will commit will be visited upon this generation. Now, the word generation is used in various ways, but in the context of this passage, he is contending with this group of individuals about the sins that they had and they would be committing. And you'll remember that the fulfillment of those kinds of things, both with regard to their crucifixion of Jesus himself shortly after, and we've been talking about the fact that these final things are within the final week of Jesus' life. And so the prediction that you would crucify some would certainly be inclusive of him as the Lord and as a prophet from God. But also the disciples and the persecution that was visited upon the disciples as recorded in Acts chapter 7 and 8, for example, which is early on in the history of the church. So all of these kinds of things that he said they would do, they did. And so the punishment that he alludes to, the woe that he pronounces upon them, the guilt of their blood, he says in verse 36, all these things will come upon this generation. Now I want you to notice as he continues on in verse 37, he specifically refers to the city of Jerusalem. "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chick under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." So you'll notice again the lament that this would happen upon that generation. There is a specific reference to the city of Jerusalem. And in verse 38, the desolation of the house, I just want you to note, looking at the various commentators, there were some differences as to whether the house would have reference to the nation, because the house of Israel, the house of Jacob. But also the word house is used with regard to the temple. And we know that when we look at what the events of AD 70, which we're going to talk a little bit about it, when Jerusalem was destroyed, that there was the complete destruction of the city and the destruction of the temple. So that in the temple proper, not one stone remained on top of another. In fact, we have those kinds of evidences that visit even to our own day. There is nothing of the edifice of the temple that remains on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The only thing that remains is a retaining wall that was a part of the outer complex. Nothing of the temple itself remains, just in fulfillment of the prophecy that the temple would be destroyed. Now, Jesus made reference and prophesied concerning the destruction of the temple on a number of occasions. You'll remember that he paralleled the destruction of the temple with his own death on the cross and his resurrection from the dead, and alluding to that. But I want you to notice that these are the things that he's been talking about, which leads to the question that is found in verse 3 of the text. When he said on the Mount of Olives, this is 24 verse 3, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming into the end of the age?" So they were looking at or listening to what he was telling about the Pharisees and the scribes and the judgment that was coming, and they wanted to know when all of this was going to happen. And so they ask those three questions that are found in verse 3 of the text. So what Jesus is doing is answering their questions in his teaching. Now, a couple of things to note before we look at that. I do want to read verses 1 and 2 because I think this is, if verse 38 of the previous chapter is not a direct reference to the destruction of the temple, it certainly is here. So after these woes are pronounced on the scribes and the Pharisees, and he's lamenting over Jerusalem, we are told that he went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. Now, I do want you to note that Herod's temple was an amazing edifice. It took over 40 years to build. Herod wanted a real ostentatious display of his magnanimous nature in giving this gift to the Jews, and so it was a beautiful thing. It was extremely large. They had enlarged the temple, the basic edifice and such, and the ground surrounding it to twice the size that it was during the time of Solomon, as I understand it. And so this was a pretty amazing thing. I'm sure that you have seen pictures in various depictions that have been given with regard to the description. So very ornate, very grandiose, very impressive. And it was something that perhaps is alluded to previous in verse 29 of chapter 23. He said, "You build the tombs of the prophets, adorn the monuments of the righteous." That kind of thing is that there was the equating at that time of zeal with this building of these edifices as being an indication of righteousness or of zeal and ardor towards God. And so as a result of this, the disciples were no doubt impressed by it and were showing Jesus the buildings and such. Jesus responds in verse 2, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." And that is the direct statement which leads them to their question. As he said on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came and asked, "When will these things be?" So here they have been just showing off the temple, or at least talking to Jesus about the temple and the edifices there. And he said to them then, that's coming to an end. That's going to be torn down. And perhaps in mind, or in their mind, were the words previously. Verse 36, "All these things will come upon this generation." And they wanted to know what would happen, what was going to take place, and when would it happen. So that's the question, or that's what led to their questions. Now, one other thing to note is we look at verse 3. And when you look at the question, there are actually three questions that are asked here in verse 3 of the text. When will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming? And the end of the age. Now, with regard to "and of the end of the age," I think there is a reference to the sign concerning the end of the age, intimated in that phrase, because he specifically differentiates between the signs which would portend the destruction of Jerusalem and the signs that would not be present when it came to the end of time, the final judgment day. Now, a question arises as to what they intended in their questions. And there are some assumptions that we would have to make to know. We don't know the minds of the apostles. What were they really asking? There is that understanding with regard to, or the view that would be obvious, that he's talking about the dissolution of the city of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, that they might equate that with what he had already been predicting about going away and coming back to get them, the references that he had made to the final day of judgment. Can you imagine the view or the mindset of the Jew if the Jew was told that his way of life is coming to an end, or the judgment is coming upon the Israelite nation, and how he might would equate that as the final judgment? So it's possible that the disciples, when they asked these questions, thought that they were asking him about just one thing. I don't know if they were or not. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. They may have been intending to ask about just the destruction of Jerusalem. But what is evident when you look at the text is that Jesus talks about two events. Jesus talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, but he also talks about the final judgment of God in this particular text. And the question that arises is, when is he talking about the first and when is he talking about the second? And that causes some problems. I was reading articles and looking at previous notes that I had, and I've got notes scribbled all through the columns of my Bible with regard to these things, and also looking at some commentaries. And came across the study of Kyle Pope. He's one that I've been alluding to or referencing quite often in my study of the book from his Truth magazine commentary. And his view is that what Jesus does here is kind of intertwine his narrative going from one point to another. He has some strong arguments to make, but he has also, there are some difficulties with that particular view. Typically, what is believed by Christians, by faithful brethren, is that from verse 3 down through verse 34 of the text, the reference is to the destruction of Jerusalem, the judgment that would come upon the nation of Israel, and the destruction itself. That verse 35, which says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away," is a transition statement before he begins to talk about, in verse 36, the final day of judgment. And you'll notice specifically in verse 36, it's obvious he is talking about the final day of judgment, because he says, "Of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." So that is obviously talking about the final day of judgment. That text begins in verse 36 and actually goes down through the end of the 25th chapter. You'll remember that not only is there a discussion of that final day in verses 36 at the end of chapter 24, but then you have the parable of the wise and foolish virgins and the parable of the talents, which were both parables dealing with that end time. And then finally in verses 31 through 46, Jesus speaks directly about the judgment of the nations. That the ones on the one hand will depart into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels, but the righteous into eternal life. And so that's the 25th chapter. The entirety of the 25th chapter is talking about the final day of judgment. And in chapter 24, there are references in teaching about the final day of judgment that are contained there as well. The question arises when you go through this text, a couple of things that comes up. You know, is he interchanging some a little bit in this regard, or is it all about the destruction of Jerusalem in the first half and all about the judgment day in the second half? And also some of the details. And I'll just give you an example of the details I'm talking about. When you get into verse 40 of Matthew chapter 24, verse 40. He says there, "Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left." And that those verses are used by premillennialists to refer to the rapture. That the righteous will be taken, the unrighteous will remain on earth. And so since we believe, and in fact in the very next chapter, we are taught that in that final day there is a resurrection of both the righteous and the unrighteous to judgment, we need to know what is meant by that, because it can't mean what they say. But what does it mean? And there are also descriptions that are given. I think the language of eschatology is used, which means the apocalyptic language, like in the book of Revelation, with some of this. And to try to correlate that it says that the sun is going to be darkened, so let's go back in history and try to find a secular source where there was a solar eclipse around this time. You know, we can't do that. That kind of language that's used both in the Old Testament and the book of Revelation, and I believe Jesus used it here, is just referencing the severe nature of judgment and it's not something that we can correlate literally with events which happened. That's one of the problems with taking apocalyptic or eschatological, which means the end time language, and trying to correlate it, because it's speculative, and you can get into a lot of problems. That's what individuals do when they, you know, they'll say, for example, the sign of the beast, and they'll say that's the Social Security numbers. And or some will, I mean, that sounds peculiar, but that's when the Social Security Administration was first started. There were a lot of religious people that says that's the mark of the beast right there. You're putting numbers on your forehead, you know. And then some people today talk about technology, and you get an implantation of a computer chip, and one day that's going to be, everybody's going to have that chip implanted, and that's going to be the mark of the beast. Then you won't be able to do commerce if you don't get the implantation of the. So that's the sign. Well, all of that is speculative. It's looking for something in the wrong direction and looking at it the wrong way. The symbolic language of the end days and of the judgment of God is hyperbolic. It is figurative. It is described as it is in order to give dark pictures of judgment and of destruction, so that it will, in effect, I don't know if you say scare, but it will express to the individuals just how serious the circumstance is. And you see some of that in the gospel account. Okay, so we've got that from the overview. And the position that I'm going to take, though I will perhaps talk a little bit about the others if we have time, is that division, the first 33 through 34 is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem, in the last section to the final day of judgment. That's just, as I understand it, the one that has the least amount of problems with it. But do keep this in mind. A couple of things. And I'll just kind of give this out. What I'm doing is going all the way to the end from the beginning, and then I'll kind of revisit it, because I want to get this construct in front of you. We're not going to have time to look at all the details. You have two events that are under consideration. I want you to think about the event which he describes, which is the destruction of Jerusalem. It would, first of all, be local in nature. Secondly, it is a judgment that is visited upon the nation of Israel, affecting the Jews. Thirdly, it would be occurring in that generation. And fourthly, there is a description of certain warning signs that those who are righteous, those who are the faithful, specifically, because he's referring to the elect, so it would be a reference to Christians in Jerusalem around these times. Listen to what I'm telling you, because you can't escape, specifically when you get to verse 15, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place. Whoever reads this, let him understand. Then those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So there are signs and there are warnings about this eventuality, and you need to be aware of it. And we also have the fulfillment of that particular thing in that generation when Jerusalem was destroyed, and it was an absolutely horrific event. Just to let you know, again, before we get into the details, the siege of Titus, which led to the destruction of Jerusalem, lasted from April to September, and it is suggested that 1.1 million people died in that siege, and primarily of starvation, that 97,000 Jews were taken captive by the Romans, and there were 600,000 dead bodies that were thrown from the gates out into outside the city and just remained there in piles. As a part of all of this process, it was described, Josephus describes people who were gnawing on leather straps because of their hunger, because that's all they had, and that they're actually, as predicted by Jesus, there were actually instances to where babies were killed and eaten as a part of this siege. So it was a horrific thing. And at the end of the siege, rather than going away, as had been done a couple of years later, there had been a previous siege by the Romans upon the city. This time, Titus went in and completely razed the city and destroyed the temple. So that's what happened in AD 70. And we see the fulfillment of those things. So that's the first event. Local, affecting the Jews, coming within that generation with warning signs. The second one that's referred to is worldwide. It affects all men. It comes at a time that we do not know. and with no signs to indicate its nearness. It comes, as stated, as a thief in the night. And both of those things are described. He talks about how you can tell when it's going to happen, and then he starts talking about how you'll never know when it's going to happen. And so it can't be talking about the same event. Now, the premillennialists, in their view, believe that Matthew, the 24th chapter, is referring to events which have yet to happen, things that have not yet happened, talking about these final days that are yet future. The preterist, and you may not be as familiar with that term, it's basically another name that is used for what's called realized eschatology. That is, the end times have already taken place. If you've heard, probably you're more familiar with the phrase the AD 70 doctrine. The AD 70 doctrine says that the end of time took place in AD 70. That the final judgment of God came in AD 70, and we are living past that time. And so that's the view that they have. They hold that the entirety of the 24th and 25th chapters have reference to the events which transpired in AD 70 in Jerusalem. And so those two views, I think, are obviously wrong, although both individuals with glee come to Matthew chapter 24 because of the language that is found there and take things out of context in order to establish their doctrines from this particular chapter. And so what you do need to know, that even though you may not can always differentiate or you don't always know about the details, what this text is obviously talking about, as we led up into Matthew 23, is the destruction of Jerusalem. But what also is noted, especially beginning in verse 36 and following, is a discussion of the final day of judgment, which differentiates between the judgment of Israel that's already taken place and that which is yet to happen. Okay? So if you want to mark in your Bibles kind of those primary thoughts, I would suggest you say in verse 3, Jesus was answering their questions. Verse 4 through 34 of the text primarily deals with the destruction of Jerusalem, and 36 and following primarily deals, or does exclusively deal with the last day. Okay? So that's kind of what I want you to get in your mind in that regard. Now, again, Brother Pope, who's a faithful gospel preacher, he takes a slightly different view, the same position, that it's talking about two different things. But his contention is some of the things, specifically the references to the end of the age, more properly can be assigned to the final day of judgment and rather than the day of Jerusalem. And, you know, that would be the general reading we would give. If you look, for example, in verse 3, their question, the end of the age. And then he begins to talk in verse 6, the end is not yet. And then he says in verse 14, the gospel of kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to the nations, and the end will come. That in fact, verses 3 through 14 primarily has reference to the final day. And then in verses 15 and following, he begins to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem, then he reverts back to it. And so that's kind of the view that he takes. There are some problems with that, but again, there are some problems with the other view as well as far as describing what is intended by it. Okay, so having said that, anybody have any questions? Are you at least understanding the general construct of the chapter before we get into some of the details? All right. I do want to answer any questions. I do want to entertain any comments that you have. You know, it's the nature of these kinds of things we're covering quickly is me basically pontificating, and I don't want to speak too much if you have questions or concerns. As we've read verse 3, then we get into verses 4 through 14. These were things that would happen before either of these two events took place. And whichever way you want to look at it, there are a couple of things. And the interesting thing about that is that and I think Brother Pope makes a good point in this regard, is what he's telling them in these first things that are mentioned is these things are going to happen, but don't let these things trouble you. This is not a sign of what's going to happen. And sometimes we take these things, okay, the rumors of wars and the pestilences and earthquakes and all of these kinds of things, that these are the things to look for to know that the destruction is going to come quickly. But in actuality, if you'll notice what he says, he said, take heed that no one deceive you, verse 4. Many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And by the way, we have a number of examples in Scripture of that happening. Two things that were mentioned is in Acts chapter 5, when I forgot his Gamaliel refers to a man who thought himself to be someone, having reference to one who was leading some astray. And you'll remember he said, with regard to the disciples, don't do anything with them, because if God's not with them, it'll come to nothing. And he's referencing these false teachers that were coming up and the false claims that were being made. And then you'll remember in Acts chapter 21, when Paul was arrested by the captain, and he escaped the mob of the Jews when he was arrested in Jerusalem, that the captain thought that he was an Egyptian who was trying to lead others astray as well. And so these are the kinds of individuals, these religious leaders that would come up as being... And by the way, that's happened throughout our time too. So we couldn't say that it's just that time that those things would happen. And that's why Pope says that maybe this has reference to the final days. So that's the first thing. Secondly, in verse 6, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. So the wars and rumors of war, nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom, famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. Well, you know, you can go to secular history and you can find examples of some of these kinds of things. Famines that occurred from between the year 30 and 670 A.D. We have an example of the brethren in Judea who were in the midst of famine as a result of the famine that was in the land. Wars, of course, secular history records those kinds of things. But at the same time, that happens in every age. These are events that people generally look to and they say, see, that's a sign, that's a sign, that's a sign. And what Jesus is saying here is, these things are going to happen, but don't let that trouble you, because that the end is not yet in regard to that. So I think that the primary point that that's being made here is that what you're supposed to be looking for is the abomination of desolation. That's the thing you need to be mindful of. Because as he talks about these, he says, these are the beginning of sorrows. They're going to deliver you up to tribulation to kill you. You'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. By the way, he's talking to his disciples. And by the way, those things happened with regard to their arrests and their persecutions and mistreatment. And he said, many will be offended. They'll betray one another, hate one another. Many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. You remember in Acts 20 where Paul said that savage wolves will rise up from among yourselves, not sparing the flock. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end. So there are going to be individuals who will fall away. I think that specific reference in verse 12 is a reference to some Christians who would lose their faith. Their love would grow cold. But he said the ones who endure to the end, they will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to the nations, and then the end will come. So, a couple of things. That's one of the problem phrases in verse 14. What is intended by that? There are a couple of things to note. First of all, if the idea is that the gospel needs to be preached throughout the ages before the end comes, the question arises, is that referring to the destruction of Jerusalem or whether it's referring to the end time? And the question then comes is, was the gospel preached to all the nations before AD 70? And secondly, has the gospel of Christ been preached to all nations today? And there's when we get into kind of speculation in that regard. Now, there's one thing we can note. Colossians chapter 3, and I think it's verse 6 of the text, the Apostle Paul affirms that it has been preached everywhere, in every place. And there is that affirmation given in Scripture that the disciples fulfilled the commission that God gave them to go and preach the gospel to every creature. Now, when we talk about all nations in that regard, it would be the known world of that time to which he refers. And we find... indications that that the entire European continent and in the Middle East and such that individuals went and evangelized in those areas. So that would be or could be a fulfillment of it, which would say that perhaps the reference is then to the destruction of Jerusalem in verse 14. Pope takes the position that the reference, again, in that the end of the age or the end will come, would have reference to the last and final judgment. Not going to be dogmatic either way, but it's a little bit more confusing if you're trying to say, well, Jerusalem's talked about here, and then it's not here, and then it is here, and then it's not there. The kind of intertwining of that seems a little bit confusing to me. So I like the clean break a little bit better. Okay, yes?
I agree with that. when Jesus says things to his disciples and answering their questions, things like this, take heed that no one deceives you. And he also says in verse 6, and you will hear the words, etc., etc. He's talking about things that his disciples will experience in their lifetime. He's not talking about things that are going to happen thousands of years into the future. He's talking about now. And like you said, I think that's what's going on here. All the way down through verse 13, he's talking about things that are going to happen to them. He who endures to the end shall be saved. The end of his life. You know, that's what he's talking about. And verse 14, I agree.
Okay. Yeah, it seems that, again, if you keep in mind, and that's part of context, remembering this, context talks about the remote context. We discussed this late Bible class this morning. The remote context having reference to the fact that whatever you view here cannot contradict other scripture because scripture doesn't contradict itself. Then you talk about the general context of the passage where he's obviously answering questions his disciples asked him because of the teaching that he did in the previous chapter, which deals with the destruction of Jerusalem. And then the immediate context is the conversation is with the disciples, and he's telling them what to look at or what they will be seeing, which ties in. And you see, I think, a change in tone when you get into verse 36, at least, very clearly. Okay, so now let us then talk about the abomination of desolation in verse 15 of the text. We're told there that when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. Let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in that day, and pray that your flight may not be in winter on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation such as not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. You see here, it's a physical judgment is under consideration here. No flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. And if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christ and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Now, with getting into those discussions of the false Christ, we'll reserve that for a few moments. But I do want you to notice the description that is given, because here we see that concept of a local event, of the immediacy, and the possibility of avoiding it. Avoiding it. Because he's indicating that if you are watching for the abomination of desolation, presumably something that they would be a bit more familiar with than what we would, because when we ask the question, what was the abomination of desolation, it's sometimes difficult for us to pin it down. I'll talk about some of the possibilities in a moment. But when you see that, leave the city of Jerusalem. Go run to the mountains. Go hide. Because it's going to be bad. That's basically what is being said here. Now, there are two places in Daniel, in Daniel 11, 31, and Daniel 21, 11, where the phrase abomination of desolation is used and translated as such in the Septuagint. In fact, in chapter 21, verse 11, the translation in the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures, it's identical to the phrase that is used here by Jesus in verse 15. Typically, and I didn't write down the notes about this, but I want you to remember during the interim of time between the end of Malachi and the beginning of Matthew, there was a period of time when there was a revolt that was led by the Maccabees against Rome. And for a period of time, there was some liberty that was granted as a result of this rebellion. They regained a semblance of their sovereignty as a result of it. But as a part of that process, one of the things which either led to the result, a revolt, or was a part of it, there was a pagan sacrifice that was offered up by the Roman general, I forget now what his name was, but offered up in the Holy of Holies, which was an abomination of desolation. Most believe that was the reference to Daniel. Jesus is paralleling that with something that was going to happen in the future. There are three possibilities that we've come across. One is the Roman Emperor Caligula, who in AD 40, that was 10 years after the death of Christ, commanded a statue of himself be put in the temple. It didn't happen, so that's probably not it. But can you imagine how that would be considered an abomination of desolation? He actually died. He was assassinated before it happened, so they were able to avoid it. In AD 66, 68, and 70, there were sieges around Jerusalem, three different occasions, which you can imagine Jews and the disciples who were aware of this prophecy that Jesus made, not would some of them leave on those occasions. In AD 66, the Jews actually stopped offering sacrifices in the temple in order to appease the Emperor Nero. So the sacrificial worship of the Jews came to an end for a period of time in order to appease him. And so there are a lot of things that kind of correlate with this concept of the abomination, desolation, standing in the holy place. And the question that kind of centers on this is the holy place referring to the temple, or is the holy place referring to Jerusalem in general? Which if it's the sieges that's under consideration, that would probably be the reference. There is nothing that is more specific than that. So we can't know exactly what Jesus was referring to. There's just not enough clarity in the secular record to know what it is. But he indicated to the disciples that they would be able to discern what it was, and when they saw it, then was the time to warn and to run in that time. And so it did happen, and it was Jerusalem was destroyed as a result of it. I knew I wouldn't have time to get through all this. But
I failed to review myself, but back when I first studied these things, I went to Josephus in the War of the Jews and read what he had to say. And he gets very specific about all the things that went on in Jerusalem, you know, leading up to the very end. And it seems like I remember, I thought it was Josephus that said this, but since you didn't stumble across it, and it must not have been. But one explanation that I had heard is that when Titus came in and finally got a hold of the city, he went in and sacrificed swine on the altar. Have you not heard this?
I thought that was that Epiphanes during the Maccabean revolt that did that. Because okay, now that you said
that
now that you said that, the reference that I saw was to swine being sacrificed, but it was during the Maccabean revolt.
Okay.
But I may be wrong about that. It's just because it was a secondhand reference, and I may have misread it.
Okay.
But,
maybe that's where I was reading. Yeah.
From what I understand, I mean, it may have been that something like that was done, but it would have been done after the walls were breached in the midst of the siege,
right,
which would have been too late as far as
the warning had the effect.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's. But again, there's hyperbolic language here describing that event. It's very colorful and very serious. You know just how horrific it was. Now we're not going to have time to cover it, but I do want you to note a couple of things as you look in verse 36 down through the end of the chapter. Verse 36, it says, the day and hour no one knows, even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Talked about how in Noah they didn't know the flood was going to happen, and the same thing is going to be in this case. Verses 40 and 41, the rest of it is pretty self-explanatory, all the way to the 25th chapter. This is the final day. Just consider this. In verses 40 and 41 of the text, it's not a reference to one being taken and the other left as far as a resurrection or an ascension into heaven, but rather the same kind of thing that is under discussion in chapter 25 in the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. The wise virgins were taken because they were prepared, and the others were left because they were not. It's not a physical taking up or anything like that that's referencing, but because of the preparation that is made by some in that day of judgment, they will be in effect taken to be with Jesus, where the others will be left to eternal destruction. It's not a physical taking that's under consideration here, but an indication of the winnowing fan and the fact that there will be a distinction between the righteous and the unrighteous as a result of these things, because we don't know when it's going to come. And when it comes, some will be ready and some won't be ready. A question that is kind of interesting, and this is one position I've never thought about it until today, so I've got to think about it before I'm going to posit it in any way. But with regard to that final day of judgment, we are told that we will rise to meet him in the air, and thus we shall ever be with the Lord. That's in the final day. What happens to the righteous dead, or the unrighteous dead? The righteous dead and those that remain will rise up. The heavens and the earth will be burned up. Will they suffer that destruction of the physical universe before they are resurrected to judgment? In other words, the events are happening. we don't have anything said in Scripture about, okay, the righteous will be resurrected and ascend to be with Jesus. And it says nothing about the unrighteous and what's going to happen to them, but it does say the earth and the works that are will be burned up. And one individual posited that the taking and the leaving would have reference to the fact that they would suffer the consequences of the burning up of the universe as a precursor to their day, you know, their day before the Lord. But it all happens on the same day. It's not something that happens and then 1,000 years passes and happens again. So I just thought that was an interesting thing, and I'd never thought of that before. So we always talk about what's going to happen to us. We're going to rise and meet Him in the air. What's going to happen to them? They're going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ, but we're going to rise to meet Him in the air. We're going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ too. So what happens to them when the earth and the universe dissolves?
That is in fun.
And I'm not going to say what's going to happen because I'm not sure. But that is an interesting thought. Appreciate very much everyone's presence today.